Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning. Please be seated. Our first case this morning is 2022-1049 in the matter of the State of Ohio versus James Jones. On behalf of Mr. Jones, Mr. Patatouse.
Thank you, Your Honor. Joseph Patatouse on behalf of Mr. Jones. I apologize for sounding as horrible as I do right now. I am a little under the weather. This case is before this court, and I would reserve 3 minutes if necessary, to determine whether or not the Court of Appeals conducted a meaningful review, which this court had previously defined in the Comer case. I know that the Comer case had been abrogated on other reasons, but that's where we first saw this this phrase, meaningful review, enter into our discourse. And here, when we start with 2953.08G2, the legislature gave to the Court of Appeals the responsibility to independently review consecutive sentences and to do so on a standard that's not an abuse of discretion standard. So we're not talking about a review where, where the Court of Appeals should just simply say, is there enough here, and pass it by. The question is, and when we look at the facts of this case, is the sentence clearly and convincingly supported by, or rather, was it demonstrated that it was not clearly and convincingly supported by law? There are a number of items that a trial court must find under 2914C4 in order to reach a consecutive finding. In the body of the text, the court must first find that the either to protect from future harm or punish the offender, plus that the sentence is not going to be disproportionate to the seriousness of the offense and the danger posed to the public. From there, it's essentially choose one of the following three. And here, I know the trial court essentially found all three. And the Court of Appeals makes reference to that in paragraphs, I believe it's 18 and 21 of its decision. The Court of Appeals, rather, makes reference that, hey, the trial court found all three. But when we look at the record, one or more of the multiple offenses where the consecutive sentences came out of were not, did not occur while he was awaiting trial or sentencing. He did pick up a DUI, and we're not hiding from that. He did pick up a DUI, I believe it's 6 months later from these two cases, but that was reduced to a misdemeanor.
But counsel, couldn't the record support prong two and prong three?
That's where I was going next, Your Honor. The common course of conduct prong, the first case was, and this is a case that should be talked about. It was, I believe, 74 marijuana or vape pen cartridges that had THC in them that was in a, quote, school zone. But when we look at the record, it was actually in his house, happened to be located 900 feet from a school during the summertime. So it wasn't as if he was trafficking in drugs from, like, at the school parking lot or something like that. The other case, he was found.
What's the difference?
What's that? I'm sorry, Your Honor.
He was in a school zone. That's
he absolutely was in a school zone, Your Honor. I just, parts of the record below seem to indicate that he was actively selling drugs in a school zone where it was found on a search warrant. It was a prep for ship case, not an actual for sale case. As it goes to the common course of conduct, the two cases, the two indictments, are completely unrelated. One involves the search warrant at the house for the 74 cartridges, and there was a pound of marijuana, and the other involves being passed out at a stoplight with a gun being found in the car. There's no allegation, there's nothing in the record that says these two cases were connected in any way. It's not as if he was leaving his house or going to do something and they got stopped twice on the same day or even the same month. They're just two different cases completely. So there's not a common course of conduct
there. So you're saying that the drug involvement, whether it's personal use or trafficking, the drug involvement alone is not enough?
No, Your Honor, I do appreciate the question. I believe that they're essentially two isolated incidents apart from each other. Neither is furthering, is how I would look at it, neither is in furtherance of the other. And there's no evidence that either was in furtherance of the other. And without that evidence and without that it being in the record, the trial court was wrong to find that, and the Court of Appeals was in error in not conducting a review there.
What about your client's past criminal history?
That was next up on my list. We have 36 out of 37 cycles. We cannot in any way dispute that. However, those are arrest cycles. The trial court did not enter a finding saying you have 36 convictions. You do not have, 36 convictions and 37 arrests. That's not in the record. The record shows that he does have, and to be fully candid, he does have felony arrests. That's absolutely true. And I believe the prior felony was, at the time of sentencing, it was either 9 or 10 years distant in the past. So it's not as if he has 36, 37 cycles, and most of those cycles, the record shows, were from the 90s. So most of those, I believe it's 28 of the 36 happened in the 90s. Cannot deny that, cannot hide from that. We're not. It's
the court wrong that said 36 arrest cycles in 37 years?
No, I believe I think it says 36 arrests, 36 of 37 cycles. I don't think it gives.
As I said, 36 arrest cycles in 37 years of life.
Yes, it did say that. Yes.
Is that accurate?
I believe so.
Okay.
I believe the PSI would support that that conclusion. But again, the bulk of those, the vast majority of those happened in the 90s. The vast majority of those are misdemeanor offenses as well. They're not felonies. They're misdemeanors. The overwhelming bulk, and that happened in the 90s.
But the statute doesn't differentiate between misdemeanors or felonies. It just says criminal conduct.
It does, Your Honor. But when conducting a review and basing a sentence on conduct that occurred in the 90s, most of the conduct occurring in the 90s, there should be some discussion and some balancing of that, which at sentencing, I believe the trial counsel did an admirable job demonstrating all of the good that Mr. Jones has tried to do. And admittedly, he does not hide from his conduct here. He does not deny his conduct. But he had, for at least 10 years, turned his life around and was going in the right direction.
So you're arguing really error on the part of the trial court, but your proposition of law is that the Court of Appeals didn't make a thorough enough or a proper de novo review. So where do we go from here?
Well, Your Honor, and that's this discussion that we've had now is kind of the bedrock for the discussion of what is the role for the Court of Appeals in these situations, in these cases. And under the statute 2953.08, the Court of Appeals needs to conduct, it doesn't say de novo, but it also the statute says it's not an abuse of discretion. So from my reading of the statute, that would be a de novo review. They have to accept the facts that the trial court gave, but ask, is there enough in the record to answer the question, was the sentence not?
Why wouldn't the standard of review be what the statute says? Doesn't, if the record does not clearly or convincingly support, the standard of review is right there.
But it's how does the Court of Appeals apply that standard, Your Honor?
How else would it apply? It's going to review the record and see if, and unless it does not clearly and convincingly support, then it has to affirm the trial court.
Your Honor, I understand that and I appreciate the question. I believe the difference is the court looking at it from an abuse of discretion standpoint, or is it looking at that from a de novo standpoint,
I don't understand the premise. The Court of Appeals is going, why wouldn't the Court of Appeals do just what the statute says? Look at it and see if the record does not clearly and convincingly support.
Your Honor, I appreciate the question, but the statute does also indicate that review is not to be conducted on an abuse of discretion basis. And abuse of discretion is such a higher standard to overcome. When the legislature had decided to insert and use that phrase, not to be reviewed on an abuse of discretion, I think that indicates, and I believe based on Comer and other cases, that indicates that the Court of Appeals is to look at the record and look at the facts that the trial court found and then answer the question. And here I believe the answer is it was not clearly and convincingly supported by the facts and the record in the case. The Court of Appeals to some degree agreed. If we look at paragraph 21, the Court of Appeals found essentially that there were two factors that weighed in favor of answering it in the opposite direction. It just regurgitated the findings, saying 36 arrest cycles in 37 years, and he had multiple gun cases. But then it went on to, and it erred by finding that there was these two cases which are going consecutive to each other, were committed while waiting sentencing or trial. Those two cases were not. So that we don't have a situation here where there were two cases being run consecutively to each other that occurred while it was pending trial. The Court of Appeals also agrees that the trial court did not make the requisite findings, but it simply said the remedy should be a nunk-pro-tunk finding, even though...
This was a plea, though, so the record is going to be sparse on the facts.
Your Honor, that is correct. It is going to be sparse on the facts. However, there was a very thorough sentencing hearing where the defense moved a substantial amount of evidence, made a substantial argument as to the underlying facts of the case. I don't believe the state contested much of what the defense raised other than simply saying he has a horrible record, 36 cycles in 37 years. Other than that, there was nothing really moved into the record. And that's when we get into plea deals. This is part of the danger that we run into, is that there was no finding, there was no statement of fact as to why the defendant is entering a change of plea, no basis for the plea other than they arrived at sentencing and the trial is, as common in trial courts, they began to just simply argue as to why he should go to prison or not and why it should be consecutive or not.
Didn't the defense stipulate to the facts as recited by the prosecutor?
Your Honor, I don't know if it was a stipulation or not. I do believe that a sparse reading of the facts was placed in. I don't want to mislead the court and say it was a stipulation or not when I simply don't recall.
Did the state recommend a sentence in this case?
No, Your Honor. The state made no recommendation that I recall in the record.
Not even just generally prison?
Your Honor, I don't have an answer to that. I don't want to mislead the court.
So under Bonnell, the Court of Appeals didn't do enough?
Under both Bonnell and Gwynn, I believe that the Court of Appeals, I don't want to use the term rubber stamp, but it essentially said, here's the findings, enter a nunc pro tunc, rather than an actual independent review of this. And centering on the findings that the trial court made, the Court of Appeals went out and said that it focused basically on the 36 cycles. That was the main.
But the nunc pro tunc just basically told the trial court to correct its entry to put the reasons into the entry.
Exactly. That's all, and that's all the Court of Appeals really did in reviewing the case is said.
No, the court. You just said paragraphs 18 to 20 that it did its review pursuant to 2953.08G. So you're saying that review wasn't sufficient enough?
Your Honor, I know I'm running out of going into my rebuttal time, but I want to answer your question. The Court of Appeals in paragraph 19 and 20 said go back and enter a nunc pro tunc to it. In paragraphs 18 and 21, it simply said this is what the trial court found. That's sufficient, with no discussion and no evaluation as to how that would actually fit the statutory requirement under 2929.14C.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. On behalf of the state of Ohio, Ms. Hutnick.
Good morning, Your Honors. Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for the Attorney General's office.
Thank you.
The issue in this case is what meaningful appellate review of consecutive sentences entails. Is it enough to fully review the record and determine whether it clearly and convincingly does not support the statutory findings, or must a reviewing court explicitly outline all of the evidence presented and make its own specific findings? The former is all that is required by law. Here, the 8th District clearly held that after reviewing the record, it could not say that the record clearly and convincingly does not support the trial court's findings, those findings being the consecutive sentence findings. In coming to its conclusion, the 8th District points out to many different points in the record. Photographs, letters of support in favor of the defendant, the 36 arrests and 36 years of life, many of those involving drugs and guns. Many of them did not result in conviction, they were just arrests. However, he did have two drug trafficking convictions, one of which was in 2008.
Counsel, so, which prong, A, B, or C, do you think was satisfied by the record clear and convincingly to allow the trial court to impose consecutive sentences?
I think C is definitely the strongest. I think it is very clear by Mr. Jones's criminal history that that definitely would support C. And I think that's absolutely the strongest finding that the trial court and the 8th District found as well.
Because it was necessary to protect the public?
Yes, I think given the fact that he had continuing to live a life of crime throughout his life, including during the pandemic. He had several arrests during the pandemic, these cases. I think it is clear that in order to protect the public that a lengthier sentence and consecutive sentences were required in this case.
Did trial court judge have discretion to go further than it did after making that finding that consecutive sentences were necessary to protect the public? Weren't there enough counts where the judge could have run some more time to protect the public?
Yes, Your Honor. The trial court very well could have run several of those cases consecutive. Instead, this trial court decided to run the two cases concurrent to each other and only the two counts in the first case consecutive to each other. So it's not
for a total aggregate sentence of
5 years.
5 years. So. Mm-hmm. Why 5 years? Do you think what does the record indicate why the judge thought 5 years would be appropriate as opposed to 10 years?
The trial court did state that it felt that the 5 years was not disproportionate to the seriousness of the conduct in this case. I think, you know, it could be perhaps that this wasn't selling to children in front of a school or anything like that. It was just in the geographic location. There could have been several factors involved in that.
Wasn't the defendant found intoxicated operating a motor vehicle?
Yes, he was found passed out behind the wheel of a vehicle, yes.
Okay.
You mentioned disproportionate. I think the 8th District noted that the trial court didn't use any words of proportion.
So the trial court did state, I don't believe 60 months is disproportionate, full stop.
Okay.
It didn't go the further.
Say it was proportionate.
Yes. It didn't go further to actually state the statute verbatim that it was not disproportionate to the seriousness of the conduct. And so it didn't say the last part of it, but it did make a disproportionate statement.
So it was half right.
I mean, I think it's clear from the trial court that it considered the disproportionality of the sentence, and it's not required to state the statute verbatim. As long as there is an indication in the transcript or in the record that those considerations were made and the findings were made as well.
So when the trial court judge noted that there were shipments of drugs coming from California to him and his wife, to their home under company names, she said, this is getting pretty close to organized crime. This isn't a user sale. Is that something the Court of Appeals could glean from the record in order to look at that proportionality question?
I think so, Your Honor. I think that as it is part of the record, I think that is something that the 8th District could look at the facts of that particular case. And consider those as well. Since this is a plea, as you pointed out earlier, we don't have the benefit of a full trial transcript in which these facts would have come in. And in this instance, it was the trial court and perhaps not the prosecutor or the defense attorney actually bringing those facts in. The only thing we have here is the trial court, the judge's actual statements that is what happened.
Yes, I was trying to figure out, was he already on probation to the judge?
This particular judge for the second and third case?
Was Mr. Jones already on probation or community control with the judge?
When the first case occurred? I don't believe so.
Okay.
My understanding is he had his drug convictions back in 2008, so I don't believe he would have still been on community control at the time of these cases, unless there was an intermediary issue. There may have been some DUIs that came through at that time. But I don't believe there was an outstanding drug conviction or anything like that.
Thank you.
It's clear from this record that the 8th District considered the trial judge's statements about the PSI, about who was actually present. The defendant's family was present, wife, grandmother, mother-in-law, a friend. It was indicated in the trial court that he owned a company, he was actively engaged in the community, and there were photos to support all of these things that was submitted in favor of the defendant. The trial court then went further and stated that, of course, as we have discussed, there were 36 arrests and 36 years of life, 10 of which those were for driving while impaired. Two resulted in drug trafficking convictions. And that on top of that, there were at least 50 traffic convictions of a various sort, weaving, speeding, that sort of thing.
I want to ask you the same question that I asked Mr. Patatus, and that is, as far as the course of conduct, what is your opinion or your research show as far as there being a course of conduct hinged on being involved with drugs, whether it's using them and passing out or trafficking in them?
I think for this instance, it's clear, though, that the course of conduct would be in that case in which the drugs were being sent from California. That would be the course of conduct. I don't, obviously that wouldn't relate to a DUI that was committed maybe a year later almost, unless he was, of course, using those drugs, but I don't think that was the case here. I believe it was alcohol for the DUI. I don't think you need to find, as in this case, the consecutive sentences were attached to two counts in the same case. And so I don't think you necessarily have to associate, for example, the DUI that occurred a year or so later to the two counts that were being run consecutive.
Thank you.
I think it's pretty clear from this record that the appeals court did consider the evidence in the record on its own and didn't necessarily defer to the trial court's findings on the face of them. It did look at things independently. And unless there were any other questions, I'll concede the rest of my time to my colleague. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Kearney, good morning.
Good morning, Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court. The court should affirm Jones's consecutive sentences for two main reasons. First, both the trial and appeals courts here did their jobs and checked all the boxes under both the C4 consecutive sentencing statute and the appellate review statute. And second, neither of Gwynn's two holdings change anything about this case, not the part about aggregate sentencing or the part about how to do appellate review. Now, I urge the court, in focusing on that key part where the trial court made this summary at pages 62 to 63 of the transcript, to read that paragraph slowly, break it down clause by clause through two lenses. The first lens is statutory and the second is the full record. The statutory lens, if you hold C4 next to those and you see the judge, it's almost as if she had perhaps the statute in front of her, memorized it from doing it so many times, of ticking off the boxes of saying, yes, this is disproportionate, yes, I find harm to the public, yes, I find this. And so, yes, sometimes there was shorthand, like saying instead of seriousness of the conduct, use the phrase, and your conduct has been atrocious, but we don't penalize trial courts for having a thesaurus and using a synonym. But also, look at it through the lens of the previous 60 pages. This isn't a five-page transcript. This is, as my friend on the other side called it, a very thorough sentencing hearing. And in those 60 pages, you see a lot of what led to that summary. For example, there is a colloquy where the judge talks about, on page 53, your accepting responsibility doesn't mean you're not going to do it again next month or 2 months from now, because that's your history. You've not learned from any of these cases because you keep repeating them. And so the court is talking about, obviously, not just disproportionate in the abstract, not disproportionate to your height and weight, but disproportionate to what's it going to take for you to learn. You've had short sentences. The court on another page talks about when he seems to be dodging responsibility for a previous case, saying, well, I didn't really do that. She's like, wait a minute, weren't you sentenced to 7 months for that? So she's saying these other short sentences didn't do enough, some of which, although there were arrests in the 90s, some of these she's asking about cases in the 2000s, in 2005 or 8 or 10. And also, in talking about harm to the public, she asks about victims. If you just do a word search for the word victim, she asks about the victim of a menacing case and asks about the victim of a domestic violence case.
Counsel,
and then,
yes, Your Honor. Let's say we agree with you that the record supports the findings under the statute. I just want to ask you generally, is the state's position that as long as the record meets that clear and convincing, the judge references without any facts, but just references the statute, and you presume that they did the analysis correctly in terms of making the decision to impose consecutive sentences. Is the state's position that as long as it's within a statutory range given by the legislature, the Court of Appeals is basically insulated from doing anything to that sentence?
In part, Your Honor, and in part, no. First, let me respectfully disagree when you said, is there clear and convincingly support? Does the record support it? Is to keep in mind, as this court explained in Gwynn, the legislature did something a little weird here of inverting the clear and convincing standard. So you're not looking at, is there clear and convincing evidence as an affirmative matter of weight to show the trial court had to find clear and convincing evidence? No, it's the reverse. The appeals court has to say, we clearly conclude, which is odd because it's saying we clearly conclude as a matter of appellate attitude or opinion as opposed to an evidentiary standard. But we have to be clear that there is an absence in the record. Mm-hmm. But in talking about it, no, just repeating the magic language is not enough. But if you repeat the magic language or use a shorthand for it, as the judge did here, and if the previous 50, 60 pages of record also has the facts, what I think the trial court does not need to do is I think you need to have both the facts and the finding, but you don't, when you repeat the finding, have to marry up one to one and say, I'm finding disproportionate because of the case of vapes, or I'm finding this because of the date, or I'm finding this because. The court made all the findings in the sum up, but if you look back, for example, talking about the vape pens, there's a part where he starts to, again, waffle on accepting responsibility and say, well, I wasn't going to sell, and the court says, well, wait, this was more than personal use. What were you going to do? They weren't going to sit on a shelf, were they? So that's talking about you were going to sell, which is, of course, harm to the public. Now, the fact that 5 pages later or 10 pages later, when you're wrapping up, you say, I find there's harm to the public. I find this isn't disproportionate. You don't have to reiterate, I find that there's harm to the public because those drugs were going to be sold on someone. As long as the components are there in the finding and the component is there at the record, the appeals court can then look at that and say, all the pieces are here. They don't have to marry it up in the trial opinion, nor does the appeals court have to say exactly how. What the appeals court did say is, oh yeah, we see a lot of stuff here.
Right.
And the fact that both the trial court and the appeals court even dealt with all the positive things, saying, look, we recognize we see these photos of community involvement, we see where he's doing this and this, shows they did a really deep dive. The fact that this trial judge asked, in a way, I'd say this is not only not inefficient or insufficient, this is a model of digging deep into this record and doing what we want courts to do, because she did not stack all of these. She gave in case 2 concurrent sentences, even the rest of case 1 concurrent, and in case 3 merely time served.
What if hypothetically the record didn't do all these things that you've essentially argued? What does a court of appeals in Ohio have the right to do if they make that finding? I'm trying to figure out what the state's position is where it's this language in 2953.08 G2, the appellate court may increase, reduce, or otherwise modify a sentence. What do you think the legislature meant by that? What power does an appellate court have to modify a sentence?
I'd say 2 things. I see 3 seconds, so I'll either talk fast or hope I can finish the question. First, what the statute says, even though it may be sometimes hard to play out, is pretty easily met here. If the appeals court asks, are we clearly and convincingly concluding that there is an absence in the record? And if there were really nothing in the record, if this person didn't have a history of criminal conduct or somehow didn't find any harm to the public, then I would say there is a point at which the court could say that clear and convincing. But that is still a pretty high standard.
Could they modify their sentence? Could they pick a sentence themselves?
I think the modification language does allow that, but it's very sparingly, because that standard is still, as even Gwynn said in paragraph 18, some amount of deference. So even though it's not abuse of discretion, it's still deferential, which is shown by the clear and convincing standard being inverted. And I know there are close cases. That's why the court's granted the Glover case. And that's, I think, a better vehicle to dive deeper into what Gwynne meant and maybe how appeals courts are being confused by the term de novo. Because normally when we hear the word de novo, we think everything's a fresh start, not de novo with some deference. So trying to figure that out's a little hard maybe in some cases. But here, the 8th District plainly did it because it did recite the statutory. We can't clearly say this record is absent, because after all, this record has aspects of all of them, including the A, B, and C under the third prong. And I know the court cleaned that up with the nunk-pro-tunk, which I don't think my friend opposes at all. This court blessed that in Bonnell, said nunk-pro-tunk is a perfectly valid way and should be used, because again, all of those findings were made on the record, and all of those findings have backup if you go back through those 58, 59 pages before you get to the big sum up. And that's where you find. I also do want to quickly mention, I know I'm in overtime, but the state did ask for time. I think that's on page 44 to 45, where the court did ask about that and talks about how the second and third case came up after the first case. We don't need to get into the details of A, but it was something that was talked about. The court realized that. The trial court took all this into account, just like the statute says, did not give max and stack, left a lot of sentences on the table, even gave 30 instead of 36. So not only is this not an error, this is a model job. This trial court did her job right. The appeals court did its job right. And this court, if it has any questions, can look at the record itself, step in the 8th's shoes, and also find and affirm that this sentence is adequate and Jones should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Patitus, you have 2 minutes, 34 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. As I believe opposing counsel has indicated, and questions from the bench, we in some ways have gone the complete opposite from saying the court does not need to use the talismanic language to, as the counsel just indicated, it's almost as if the court had shorthand. Most judges now, especially in Cuyahoga County, have the practice of actually having a exact shorthand form, and at the end of sentencing, they merely just read from the form, and that's common practice, and I think counsel would agree that's the case. So I don't believe reading that form and just putting that language into the record satisfies 2953.08G2 or 2929.14.4C. That's not in any way to diminish or anything that the trial courts do. These sentencing statutes are complex and confusing, and there's a lot to go through. But it's almost as if we've had a paradigm shift from you need to make specific findings using specific language to now I'm just going to read it from a card or just use shorthand. And I think that's what we have here. And even having that, the trial court still did not do an analysis of the disproportionate sentencing to the danger of harm to the public. It didn't do any analysis in the record, and that's where the Court of Appeals erred, because in going in and doing its own analysis, it needed to go in and look at the facts that counsel talked about and make a determination, do those facts constitute and warrant this sentence? And that's the review. What counsel just did is the review. That's
how would an Ohio trial court judge make a proportionality assessment of whether 5 years is appropriate? I mean, they don't have data about what their past sentences are, right?
Correct.
They don't have data what their other judges have imposed on similarly situated defendants. So how does a Ohio trial court judge actually make a proportionality that 5 years was appropriate?
That's a question, Your Honor, that's respectfully above my pay grade. That is a challenge that I face every day and my firm faces every day in arguing sentences to courts. There is no publicly available database that we haven't seen other states and federal courts. We simply don't have that here. But the trial court still needs to undertake an effort to do that rather than merely regurgitating the words off of a shorthand form at the end of sentencing. I see that my time is up. I thank you for your time, Your Honors.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement, and you will receive a decision from the court.